Chapter 13. Faith or Duty. Bonded. The Warrant. The summons came from the Vindicari, and so Iota joined Kel and the rest of the execution force in one of several storage rooms down in the web of caves, away from the more heavily populated sections of the hideaway. The room smelled of promethium. Drums of the liquid fuel were stacked to the ceiling in corners, and the air circulation system worked in fits and starts. Kel had been careful to time the gathering to coincide with the regular overflights of clan patrol craft. Every time it happened, the rebels would fall silent, go dark, and wait for the flyers to make their loop over the blade cut before heading back to the city. It meant that Capra, Bay, Groll, and the others were all occupied, allowing the assassins to gather unnoticed, at least for a little while. The Vindicare surveyed the room, looking at them all in turn. Iota noted that he looked to Solm last of all, and seemed to linger on her. She wondered if his sibling understood the meaning behind that fractional moment. Iota regarded her understanding of human social interaction as an ongoing experiment, but her limited knowledge also afforded her a clarity that others lacked. For all the distance between the brother and sister, it seemed obvious to the Culexus that Kel cared for Solm more than the woman knew, or wanted to know.
"We're entering the final phase," Kel said without preamble. "Bay's contacts in the city have sent word of sightings at the perimeter of the Dagonet system. Warp disturbances. The prelude to the opening of a gateway."
"How long until we know for sure?" asked Coyne.
The Calidus looked like a child's doll, the size of a man, all sketched, incomplete features and pale skin.
"We can't stay put and wait for confirmation," Tariel said, without looking up from his cogitator gauntlet's keyboard. "By the time the warships enter orbit, it will be too late."
The Garantine made a rumbling noise in the back of his throat that appeared to be an affirmation.
"We commit now," said Kel. "The lance has been concealed, yes?"
He looked at Tariel, who nodded.
"Aye," said the Infocyte. "Groll supplied transport from the starport. I supervise the assembly of the component parts myself. It's ready."
"But there's no way to test it, is there?"
Coyne leaned forwards. "If this doesn't work..."
"It will work," Kel insisted. "Everything we've done has been leading up to this moment. We're not going to start second-guessing ourselves now."
"I was only making an observation," said the Shade. "As I will be the closest to the target, I think it's fair to say I have the most invested in a trouble-free termination."
"Don't fret," said the Eversaw. "You won't get too dirty."
"We have fallback options in place."
Kel ignored the comment and nodded towards Iota and Solm.
"But for now, we concentrate on the primary schema."
He paused and threw Tariel a look. The Vanus operative consulted a timer window among the panes of hololiths hanging before him, and then glanced up.
"The Clanner Patrol should be heading back to the capital at any moment."
"And we'll follow them."
Kel reached for his spy mask, where it hung from his gear belt.
"You all have your own preparations to make. I suggest you complete them in short order and then head out. Each of us will go back into the capital individually via different routes and rendezvous at the starport. I'll be waiting for you aboard the Ultio after sunset."
The only member of the group who did not move after Kel's dismissal was Solm. She looked at the Vindicare, her lips thinning.
"Has Capra been informed?"
"Don't be a fool,"
snorted the Eversaw, before the other man could even speak.
"We may have killed one of the turncoats in this little plague gang of rebels, but there are likely others, watching and waiting for something juicy to report before they betray this place."
The Garantine opened his clawed hands.
"These people are amateurs. They can't be trusted."
Solm was still looking at Kel.
"What are they supposed to do after it's done?"
Iota saw colour rise in the Vindicare's cheeks, but he kept his temper in check.
"Capra is resourceful. He'll know what to do."
"If he has any sense," muttered Coyne, "he'll run."
Solm turned away and was the first from the chamber. Jenica reached the compartment Bay had assigned to her and went in. What little equipment she had was there, cunningly disguised as a lady traveller's attaché. It seemed strangely out of place among such drab accommodation, on the Imperial Army surplus bedroll beside a drawstring bag of ration packs. She paused, studying it. Inside the case, concealed inside clever modules and secret sections, there were vials of powder, flat bottles of colourless fluid, thin strips of metallized chemical compounds, injectors and capsules and dermal tabs. The manner and means to end an entire city's worth of human lives, if need be. For a while, she thought about how simple it would be to introduce a filter of time-release metasarin into the water system of the rebel hideout. Tailored with the right mix, she could make it painless for them. They would just fall asleep, never to wake. They would be spared the brutal deaths that were fated to them all, the payment that would be exacted, no matter if the execution force succeeded or failed. She thought about Lady Sinope, of trusting Bay, and the ever-suspicious Groll. Some might have said it would be a mercy. The War Master was not a magnanimous conqueror. Solm shook her head violently to dispel the thought, and hated herself in that instant. "I am not Aristide," she whispered to the air. A sharp knock at the rusted metal door startled her. "Hello," said a voice. She recognized it as one of the men she had seen in the makeshift chapel. "Are you in there?" She slid the door open.
"What is it?"
The man's face was flushed with worry.
"They're coming,"
he husked. She didn't need to ask who they were. If Bay's contacts in the city had spoken to Capra, then it was logical to assume that others in the rebel encampment knew of what was on the horizon as well.
"I know."
He pressed something into her palm.
"Sinope gave me this for you."
It was a tarnished Vok locket, a type of portable recording device that lovers or family members give to one another as a memento. The device contained a tiny, short-duration memory spool and hologram generator.
"I'll be outside."
He pulled the door shut, and Solm was alone in the room again. She turned the locket over in her hands and found the activation stud. Holding her breath, she squeezed it. A grainy hololith of Lady Sinope's face, no larger than Jenica's palm, flickered into life.
"Dear child," she began,
an urgency in her words that Solm had not heard before.
"Forgive me for not asking this of you in person, but circumstances have forced me to leave the caves. The man who gave you this is a trusted friend, and he will bring you to me."
The noblewoman paused, and she seemed to age a decade in the space of a single breath.
"We need your help. At first I thought I might be mistaken, but with each passing day it has become clearer and clearer to me that you are here for a reason. He sent you, Jenica. You said yourself that you are only a messenger, and now I understand what message you must carry."
The image flickered as Sinope glanced over her shoulder, distracted by something beyond the range of the locket's tiny sensor camera. She looked back, and her eyes were intense.
"I have not been truthful with you. The place you saw, our chapel, there's more than just that. We have a, I suppose you could call it a sanctuary. It is out in the wastes, far from prying eyes. I will be there by the time you receive this. I want you to come here, child. We need you. He needs you. Whatever mission may have brought you to Dagonet, what I ask of you now goes beyond it."
She felt the woman's gaze boring into her.
"Don't forsake us, Jenica. I know you believe with all your heart, and even though it pains me to do so, I must ask you to choose your faith over your duty."
Sinope looked away.
"If you refuse, the rains of blood will fall all the way to Holy Terror."
The hologram faded, and Solm found her hands were shaking. She could not look away from the locket, grasping it in her fingers as if it would magically spirit her away from this place. Lady Sinope's words, her simple words, had cut into her heart. Her emotions twisted tight in her chest. She was a sworn agent of the Officio Assassinorum, a secluse of the Clade Venenum, ranked at Epsilon Dan. And she had her orders. But she was also Jenica Solm, Jenica Kell, a daughter of the Imperium of Man and loyal servant of the divine God-Emperor of humanity. Which path would serve him best? Which path would serve his subjects best? Try as she might, she could not shake off the power behind Sinope's message. The quiet potency of the noblewoman had bled into the room, engulfing her. Solm knew that what she was being asked to do was right, far more so than a blood-soaked mission of murder that would only lead to death on a far greater scale. The Church of the Lectitio Divinitatus on Dagonet needed her. When she had needed help after mother and father and then Aristide had been lost to her, it was the word of the God-Emperor that had given her strength. Now that debt was to be answered. In the end, she realized there was no question of what to do next. The door opened with a clatter, and the rebel soldier started, turning to see the pale assassin woman standing on the threshold. She had an elaborately etched wooden case over her shoulder on a strap, and was in the process of attaching a holstered backed gun to her belt. She looked up, her hood already up about her head.
Sinope said you would take me to her.
He nodded gratefully.
Oh, yes, of course. This way, follow me.
The rebel took a couple of steps and then halted, frowning.
The others? Your comrades?
They don't need to know,
said Solm, and gestured for him to carry on. The two of them disappeared around a curve in the corridor, heading up towards the surface. From the shadows, Iota watched them go. Spear loathed the warp. When he travelled through the screaming halls of the Immaterium, he did his best to ensure that he did so in stasis, his body medicated into hibernation, or failing that, if he were forced to remain awake by virtue of having assumed the identity of another, then he prepared himself with long hours of mental rituals. Both were in order to calm the demon skin. In the realms of normal space, on a planet or elsewhere, the molecule-thin layer of living tissue bonded to his birth flesh was under his control. Oh, there were times when it became troublesome, when it tried to defy him in small ways, but in the end, Spear was the master of it. And as long as it was fed, as long as he sated it with killings and blood, it obeyed. But in the depths of warp space, things were different. Here, with only meters of steel and the gauzy energy web of a Geller field between him and the thunder and madness of the ethereal, the demon skin became troublesome. Spear wondered if it was because it sensed the proximity of its kindred out there, in the form of the predatory, almost sentient life that swarmed unseen in the wake of the starships that passed. Eurotas had granted him the use of a ship called the Yelin, a fast cutter from the consortium's courier fleet designed to carry low-mass, high-value cargoes on swift system-to-system runs. The Yelin's crew were among the best officers and men the clan had to offer, but Spear barely registered them. He gave the captain only two orders. The first was to make space for Dagonet at maximum speed. The second was not to disturb him during the journey unless the ship was coming apart around them. The crew all knew who Hissos was. Among some levels of the Eurotas clan's hierarchy, he was seen as the Void Baron's attack dog, and that reputation served Spear well now, glowering through another man's face at everyone he saw before locking himself into the opulent passenger cabin provided for his use. The cabin was detailed in rich red velvet that made the murderer feel like he was drowning in blood. That comforted him, but only for a while. Once the Yelin was in the thick of the warp, the demon skin awoke and cried in his mind like a wounded, whining animal. It wanted to be free, and for a long moment so did Spear. He pushed the thought away as if he were drawing back a curtain, but it snagged on something. Spear felt a pull deep in his psyche, clinging to the tails of the disloyal emotion. Sabrat!
No, 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 no!
Furious, Spear launched himself at a bookcase along one of the walls and slammed his head into it, beating his malleable face bloody. The impact and the pain forced the remnant of the dead Reeves persona away again, but the demon skin was still fretting and writhing, pushing at his tunic, issuing tendrils from every square centimetre of bare flesh. It would not obey him. The moment of slippage, the instant when the corpse mind shard had risen to the fore, had allowed the demon skin to gain a tiny foothold of self-control.
"That won't do,"
he hissed aloud, and strode over to the well-stocked drinks cabinet. Spear found a bottle of rare Umbran brandy and smashed it open at the neck. He doused the bare skin of his arms with the rich, peaty liquid, and the tendrils flinched. Then he tore open the lid of a humidor on a nearby desk and took the ever taper from within. At the touch of his thumb, it lit, and he jabbed it into the skin. A coating of bluish flame engulfed his hands, and he bunched his fists, letting the pain seep into him. The fire and the pain. Outside the ship, there is nothing but fire. Inside, only pain. Where he stands, he is shackled to the deck by an iron chain thicker than a man's forearm. Heavy double links reaching to a manacle around his right leg. It is so tightly fastened that he would need to sever the limb at the knee to gain his freedom. His attention is not on this, however. One wall of the chamber in which the master's warriors placed him is not there. Instead, there is only fire, burning madness. He is aware that a thin membrane of energy separates that inferno from him. How this is possible, he cannot know. Such science sorcery is beyond him. He knows only that he is looking into the warp itself, and by turns the warp looks back into him. He howls and pulls at the chain. The runes and glyphs drawn all over his naked body are itching and inflamed, cold hot and torturing him. The warp is pulling at the monstrous, unknowable words etched into him. He howls again, and this time the master answers.
"Be afraid," Erebus tells him. "The fear will soothe the bonding. It will give it something to sink its teeth into."
He can't tell where the voice is coming from. Like so many times before, ever since the opening of the cage, Erebus seems to be inside his thoughts whenever he wishes to be. Sometimes the master comes in there and leaves things, knowledge, ability, thirsts, and sometimes he takes things instead, memories, perhaps. It's not easy to be certain. He has questions, but they die in his throat when he sees the thing coming from the deeps of the warp. It moves like mercury, shimmering and poisonous. It sees him. Erebus anticipates his words.
"A minor phylum of warp creature," explains the master. "A predator. Dangerous, but less than intelligent. Cunning, in a fashion."
It is coming. The gauzy veil of energy trembles. Soon it will pucker and open, just for the tiniest of moments, enough to let it in.
"It can be domesticated," says the word-bearer, "if one has the will to control it. Do you have the will, Spear?"
"Yes, master."
He does not finish his words. The predator demon finds the gap and streams through it, into the opened bay of the starship. It smothers him, skirling and shrieking its joy at finding a rich, easy kill. This is the moment when Erebus allows himself a noise of amusement. This is the moment when the demon, in its limited way, realizes that everywhere it has touched Spear's flesh, across every rune and sigil, it cannot release. It cannot consume. And he collapses to the deck, writhing in agony as it tries to break free, fails, struggles, and finally merges. As the hatch closes off the compartment from the red hell outside, Spear hears the master's voice receding.
"It will take you days of agony to dominate it, and failure will mean you both die. The magics etched into you cannot be broken. You are bonded now. It is your skin. You will master it, as I have mastered you."
The words echo and fade, and then there is only his screaming, and the demon's screaming, and the fire, and the pain. A thin and cold drizzle had come in with the veil of night. and all across the starport the rain hissed off the cracked, battle-damaged runways and landing pads in a constant rush of sound. Water streamed off the folded wingtips of the Ultio's forward module, down through the broken roof of the hangar, spattering against the patch of dry ferrocrete beneath the vessel, where it crouched low to the ground. It resembled an avian predator, ready to throw itself into the sky, but for now the ship's systems were running in dark mode, with nothing to betray its operable state to the infrequent patrols that passed by. The starport had remained largely abandoned since the start of the insurrection. It was still a long way down the Klanner government's long list of important infrastructure repairs. Rebel strikes against power stations and communications towers made sure of that, although Capra had been careful that lines of supply were kept open so that the native populace would not starve. He was winning hearts and minds, for all the good that would do him in the long run. Kel stood at the foot of the Ultio's landing ramp and peered into the rain through the eye-band of his spy mask, letting the built-in sensors do their work, considering the freedom fighters once more. How would they react when they found the members of Kel's team gone? Would they think they had been betrayed? Perhaps so. After all, they had been, in a way. And when the mission reached its endpoint, Capra would know full well who had been behind it.
Any sign?
Tariel's voice filtered down from above him.
The pilot brain reports that the passive sensors registered a blip a short time ago, but since then nothing.
Kel didn't look up at him.
Status?
Tariel gave a sigh.
The quarantine has sharpened his knives so much he could slice the raindrops in two. I am monitoring the public and military vox nets, and I have prepared and loaded all my data phages and blackouts. Coin is in the process of mimicking the form of the troop commander we captured. I take it the Culexus and the Venenum have still yet to arrive?
Your powers of perception are as sharp as ever.
How long can we afford to wait? He replied. We're very close to the deployment time as it is.
They'll be here, Kel said,
just as something shimmered in the downpour beyond the open hangar doors.
I am, said Iota,
emerging from the grey rain. Her voice had a strange echoing timbre inside her skull helmet. She removed the weapon helm as she stepped into cover and shook loose the thin threads of her braided hair.
I was delayed.
By what? Tariel demanded.
There's nobody out there.
Nobody out there now, Iota gently corrected.
Where's the Venenum?
Said Kel, his jaw stiffening. Iota glanced at him.
Your sister isn't coming.
Kel's eyes flashed with shock and annoyance.
How?
Tariel held up his hands in a gesture of self-protection.
Don't look at me. I said nothing.
The Vindicari grimaced.
Never mind. That's not important. Explain yourself. What do you mean she's not coming?
Janica has taken on a mission of greater personal importance than this one, the Culexus told him.
I gave her an order,
he barked, his ire rising by the second.
Yes, you did. And she disobeyed it.
Kel grabbed the other assassin by the collar and glared at her. He felt the black shadow of the pariah's soul-shriveling aura rise off her in a wave, but he was too furious to care.
You saw her go, didn't you? You saw her go and you did nothing to stop it.
A flicker of emotion crossed Iota's face, but it was difficult to know what it was. Her dark eyes became solid orbs of void.
You will not touch me.
Kel's skin tingled, and his hand went ice cold, as if it had been plunged into freezing water. Reflexively, he let the Culexus go, and his fingers contracted in pain.
What were you thinking, girl?
He demanded.
You don't own her, Iota said in a low voice. You gave up your part in her life.
The comment came out of nowhere, and Kel was actually startled by it.
This is about the mission,
he went on, recovering swiftly.
Not about her.
You tell yourself that, and you pretend to believe it.
Iota straightened up and stepped around him. He turned. At the top of the ramp, Tariel had been joined by the Garantine, the Eversaur rocking back and forth, his massive hands clenching and unclenching with barely restrained energy. A middle-aged man in PDF issue rain slicker stood nearby, toying with a poison knife. The expression of the face that Coyne had borrowed was wrong, ill-fitting in some way that Kell could not express.
How much longer?
Snarled the Eversaw.
I want to kill an Astartes. I want to see how it feels.
His jittery fingers played with the straps of his skull mask, and the pupils of his bloodshot eyes were black pinpricks. Kell made a decision and stepped after the Culexus.
Iota, do you know where she went?
I have an inkling, came the reply.
Fine, Solm. Bring her back.
Now?
Said Tariel, his face falling.
Now, of all times?
Do it, Kell insisted. If she has been compromised, then our entire mission is blown.
That's not the reason why, said Iota. But we can tell her it is, if you wish.
The Vindicare pointed back out into the rains, which had begun to grow worse.
Just go.
He looked away. There was something in his chest, something there he had thought long since vanished, an emptiness, a regret. He smothered it before it could take hold, turning it to anger.
Damn her for bringing these feelings back to the surface.
She was part of a past he had left behind, and he wanted it to remain that way. And yet... Iota gave him a nod, and her helmet rose to cover her face. Without looking back, she broke into a run and was quickly swallowed up by the deluge. The Garantine came stomping down the ramp, seething.
What are you doing, sniper?
He spat the words at him.
That gutless poisoner flees the field and you make things worse by sending the witch away as well? Are you mad?
Is the notorious Garantine actually admitting he needs the help of women? Said Coyne, in the troop commander's voice.
Wonders never cease.
The Eversaw Rage Killer loomed over the Vindicare.
You're not fit to lead this unit. You never were. You're weak, and now your lack of leadership is compromising us all. You understand nothing,
Kell snarled back. A steel-taloned finger pressed on his chest.
You know what's wrong with your clade, Kell. You're afraid to get the blood on you. You're scared of the stink of it. You want things all neat and clean, dealt with at arm's length.
The Garantine jerked a thumb at Coyne.
Even that sexless freak is better than you.
Charming, muttered the Calidus. The Eversaw went on, hissing out each word in pops of spittle through bared teeth.
Valdoch must have been making sport when he puts you in charge of this mission. Do you think we're all blind to the way you look at the Venenum, bitch?
In an instant, Kell's Exitus pistol was in his hands, and then the muzzle of it was buried in the exposed flesh of the Garantine's throat, pressing into the stressed muscles and taut veins.
Kell!
Tariel called out a warning.
Don't!
The Eversaw laughed.
Oh, go on, sniper. Do it! Up close and personal for the first time in your life.
His clawed hands came up, and he rammed the gun into the thick flesh beneath his jaw.
Prove you have some backbone. Do it!
For a second, Kell's finger tightened on the trigger. But to murder an Eversaw Rage Killer at point-blank range would be suicidal. The gene modifications deep inside the Garantine's flesh contained within them a critical failsafe system that would, should the assassin's heart ever stop, create a combustive bio-meltdown powerful enough to destroy everything close at hand. Instead, Kell put all his effort into a vicious shove that propelled the Garantine away.
If I didn't need you, he growled, I'd blow a hole in your spine and leave you crippled and bleeding out.
The Eversaw sniggered.
You just made my argument for me.
This is pointless, snapped Coyne, striding down the ramp. No mission plan ever works as it should. Every one of us knows that. We can complete the assignment without the women. The primary target is still within our reach.
The Calidus is correct,
added Tariel, working his cogitator.
I'm reconfiguring the protocols now. There are overlapping attack vectors. We can still operate with two losses.
As long as no one else walks off, said the Garantine. As long as nothing else changes.
Kell's face twisted in a grimace.
We're wasting time, he said, turning away. Secure the Ultio and move out to your kill points.
The man's name was Tross, and he didn't talk much. He led Solm out of the caverns through a vaulted hall of rock that had once held fuel rods for Dagonet's long-dead atmosphere converters, and to a waiting GEV skimmer. Once they were on their way out into the wilds, the noise of the hovercraft's engines made conversation problematic at best. The assassin decided to sit back behind the rebel and let him drive. The skimmer was fast. They wound through the canyons of the Blade Cut at breakneck speed, and then suddenly the wall of rock dropped away around them, falling into the ochre desert. As storm clouds rolled in above them from the west, they went deeper and deeper into the wilderness. From time to time, Solm saw what might have been the remains of abandoned settlements. They dated back to the early colonist decades, back to when this desert had been fertile arable land. That had been in Dagonet's green phase, before the human-altered atmosphere had changed again, shifting the good climate northwards. The population had moved with it, leaving only the shells of their former homes lying like broken, scattered tombstones. Finally, the GEV's engine note downshifted, and they began to slow. Tross pointed to something in the near distance, and Solm glimpsed the shapes of tents flapping in the winds, low pergolas and yurts arranged around the stubs of another forsaken township. As the skimmer closed in and settled to the sand in a cloud of falling dust, what caught her eye first was the mural of an imperial aquila along one long pale wall. It looked old, weather-beaten, but at the same time it shone in the fading daylight, as if it had been polished to a fine sheen by decades of swirling sand. There had only been a handful of people in the makeshift chapel hidden in the rebel base, and Solm had been slightly disappointed to see how few followers of the God Emperor were counted among the freedom fighters. But she realized now that small group had only been a fraction of the real number. The followers of the Lectitio Divinitatis were here. She stepped from the skimmer and walked slowly into the collection of improvised habitats and reclaimed half-buildings. Even at first glance, Solm could see that there were hundreds of people, adults and children, young and old, men and women, from all walks of life across Dagonet's society. Most of them wore makeshift sand cloaks or hoods to keep the ochre dust from their mouths and noses. She saw some who carried weapons, but they did so without the twitchy nervousness of Capra's rebels. One man, with a lasgun, eyed her as she passed him, and Solm saw he was wearing the remnants of a PDF uniform, tattered and ripped in the places where the insignia had been stripped off, all except the aquila, which he wore proudly. These people, the refugees, were in the process of gathering themselves together for the coming night, tying down ropes and securing sheets. Out here, the winds moved swiftly over the open desert, and the particles of dark dust would get into everything. The first curls of the breeze pulled at the hems of her robes as she walked on. Tross matched her pace and pointed to a strangely proportioned building with a slanted wall and a forest of skeletal antennae protruding from where its roof should have been.
Over there!
These are Lady Sinope's followers? She asked.
The man gave a snort of amusement.
Don't say that to her face. She'd think it disrespectful.
Tross shook his head.
We don't follow her. We follow him. Milady just helps us on the path.
You knew her before the insurrection?
Well, I knew of her, he corrected. My Da met her once when she was a younger woman. Heard her speak to a secret meet at Dusker Point. Never thought I'd have the chance myself, though. Milady's done much for us over the years.
Your family have always been a part of the Imperial cult, then?
Tross nodded.
But that's not a name we use here. We call ourselves the Theoge.
They approached the building, and at once Solm realized that it was no such thing. The construction was actually a small ship, a good measure of its keel buried in the cracked, ruddy earth. Beyond it, she saw the rusted frames of dock wharfs extending into the air.
Once, this place had been a wide river canal. There were tents arranged along the side of the old vessel, each lit from within by lamplight. The people here are all from Dagonet?
And other worlds on the Axis, said the man. Some of them were here on pilgrimages in secret. Got trapped when the clan of nobles tipped everything up.
Pilgrimage? She repeated. For what reason?
Tross just nodded again.
You'll see.
He opened a heavy steel hatch for her, and she went inside. The old ship had once been a freighter, perhaps a civic transport belonging to some branch of the colonial administratum. Now all that stood was the gutted shell, the sand-blasted hull, and the corroded metal frames of the decks. Inside, the skeleton of the vessel had been repurposed with new walls made of dry stone or steel from the hulls of cargo containers. The door closed with a solid thump behind Solm and took the brunt of the wind with it. Only a tendril of chill air reached through to paw at the small drifts of sand in the entryway.
Child!
Sinope approached, and she had tears in her eyes.
Oh, child, you came. Throne bless you.
I owed it, said the Venenum. I had to.
Sinope smiled briefly.
I never doubted you would. And I know I have asked a lot from you to do this. I have put you at risk.
I was on a mission I did not believe in, she replied. You asked me to take up another for something I do believe in. It was no choice at all.
The noblewoman took her hand.
Your comrades will not see it the same way. They may disown you.
Likely, Solm replied. But I lost what I thought of as my family a long time ago. Since then, the only kinship I have had has been with others who know the God Emperor as we do.
We are your family now,
said Sinope.
All of us.
Solm nodded at the rightness of the old woman's words, and she felt lifted.
Yes, you are.
But then the moment of brightness faded as her thoughts returned to the content of the Vocklocket message. She retrieved the device and pressed it back into Sinope's thin, wrinkled hands.
How can I help you?
Come.
She was beckoned deeper into the shadowed wreck.
Things will become clearer.
The beached ship, like the camp beyond it, was filled with people, and Solm saw the same expression in all of them, a peculiar mingling of fear and hope. With slow alarm, she began to understand that it was directed towards her.
Tras said you have refugees from all over Dagonet here, and from other worlds as well.
Sinope nodded as she walked.
I hope, I pray, that there are other gatherings hiding in the wilds. It would be so sad to admit that we are all that is left.
But there must be hundreds of people here alone.
Another nod.
416 at last count. Mostly Dagonetti, but a handful of visitors from other worlds and the Tibian stars.
She sighed.
They came so far and sacrificed so much, and now they will never return home.
Help is coming.
Solm had said the lie so many times over the past few weeks that it had become automatic. The noblewoman stopped and gave her a look that cut right through the falsehood.
We both know that is not true. The God Emperor is embattled, and his continued existence is far more important than any one of us.
She gestured around.
If we must perish so that he may save the galaxy, that is a price we will gladly pay. We will meet again at his right hand.
Sinope's quiet zeal washed over her. Solm took a second to find her voice again.
How long has the Theoge been here?
Before I was born. Generations before,
said the old woman, continuing on.
Before the age of the Great Crusade, even. It is said that when the God Emperor walked the turbulent earth, even then there were those who secretly worshipped him. When he came to the stars, that belief came with him. And then there was the Lectitio Divinitatus, the book that gave form to those beliefs, the Holy Word.
Is it true that it was written by one of the God Emperor's own sons?
I do not know, child. All we can be sure of is that it is the imperial truth.
She smiled again.
I grew up with that knowledge. For a long time, we and others like us lived isolated lives, ignored at best, decried at worst. We who believed were thought to be deluded fools.
Solm looked around. These people don't look like fools to me.
Indeed. Our numbers have started to swell, and not just here. Groups of believers all across the galaxy are coming together. Our faith knows no boundaries, from the lowliest Hiver child to men who walk the palaces of Terra itself.
She paused, thinking.
The darkness sown by the War Master has brought many to our fold. In the wake of his insurrection, there have been horrors and miracles alike. This is our time of testing, of that I have no doubt. Our creed is in the ascendant, dear child. The day will come when all the stars bend their knee to Holy Terra and the God Emperor's glory.
But not yet, she said, an edge of bitterness in her voice. Not today. Sinope touched her arm.
Have faith. We are part of something larger than ourselves. As long as our belief survives, then we do also.
The people from the other worlds, Solm pressed. Tras said they were here on a pilgrimage. I don't understand that.
Sinope did not reply. They followed a patched metal staircase into the lower levels of the old ship, treading with care to avoid broken spars and fallen stanchions. Down here, the stink of rust and dry earth was heavy and cloying. After a few meters, they came to a thickly walled compartment, armored with layers of steel and ceramite. Four men, each armed with heavy caliber weapons, were crowded around the only hatchway that led inside. They had hard eyes and the solid, dense builds of humans from heavy gravity worlds. The assassin knew immediately that they were, to a man, career soldiers of long and lethal experience. Each of them gave a respectful bow as Sinope came into the light cast from the looms overhead, doffing their caps to the old woman. Solm watched her go to each in turn and talk with them, as if they were old friends. She seemed tiny and fragile next to the soldiers, and yet it was clear that they hung on her every word and gesture, like a troop of devoted sons. Her smiles became theirs. Sinope gestured to her.
Gentlemen, this is Jenica.
She's the one,
said the tallest of the four, a heavy stubber at rest in his hands. Sinope nodded.
You have all served the Theodes so selflessly, she told them, and your duty is almost done. Jenica will take this great burden from you.
The tall man gave a regretful nod and then snapped his fingers at another of the four. The second soldier worked the thick wheel in the center of the hatch, and with a squeal of rusted metal, he opened the door to the cargo compartment. Sinope advanced inside, and Solm followed warily behind her. It was gloomy and warm, and there was a peculiar stillness in the air that prickled her bare skin. The hatch closed with a crunch.
Dagonet is going to fall, said the noblewoman, soft and sorrowful. Death is close at hand. The God Emperor's love will preserve our souls, but the ending of our flesh has already been written. He cannot save us.
Solm wanted to say something, to give out a denial, but nothing would come.
He knows this. That is why, in his infinite wisdom, the Master of Mankind had you brought to us in his stead, Jenica Solm.
No, she managed, her heart racing.
I am here in service to a lie, to perish for a meaningless cause. I have not even been spared the grace to have a truth to die for.
Sinope came to her and embraced the assassin.
Oh, dear child, you are mistaken. He sent you to us because you are the only one who can do what we cannot. The God Emperor turned your destiny to cross my path. You are here to protect something most precious.
What do you mean?
The noblewoman stepped away and moved to a small metal chest. She worked a control pad on the surface, a combination of biosensor blood locks and security layers, and Solm stepped closer to get a better look. She knew the design. The chest was of advanced Martian manufacture, A highly secure transport capsule fitted with its own internal support fields, capable of long-term survival in a vacuum, even atmospheric re-entry. It was very much out of place here. The chest opened in a gust of gas, and inside, Solms saw the shimmer of a stasis envelope. Within the ephemeral sphere of slowed time was a book of the most ornate, fantastic design, and it seemed to radiate the very power of history from its open pages.
"See,"
said Sinope, bowing deeply to the tome.
"Look, child, and see the touch of his hand."
Solms' gaze misted as tears pricked her eyes. Before her, gold and silver and purple illuminated, a stark page of vellum. On it, the portrait of the angelic might of the God Emperor, standing over a kneeling man in the finery of a rogue trader. In the trader's hands, this book, and falling from his master's palm, the shimmering droplet of crimson vitae that rested on the recto page. The scarlet liquid glittered like a flawless ruby, frozen in that distant past, as bright and as new as it had been the second it fell.
"Emperor's blood," she whispered.
Jenica Solms sank to her knees in unrestrained awe, bowing her head to the warrant of trade of the clan Uratas.